One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is the co-host and producer of one of our very favorite podcasts, Die Hard on a Blank, as well as its Patreon spinoff show, 48 Hours of Buddy Movies. He's also produced a ton of scripted and unscripted podcasts, documentary and narrative films, and more. He's an expert. He's a mensch. Please welcome the delightful Liam Billingham. Hey, Liam.
Gentlemen, it's nice to see you. I love this show. Thank you for having me on it. I'm going to confess right off the gate that I feel a little insecure about the lack of stuff on the wall behind me. But this doubles as my son's bedroom, and we're in California, so I don't want pictures falling on him while he sleeps in the event of an earthquake, like Sunday night when the whole house shook. So I just want your audience to know that I'm not a serial killer. I just don't have anything on the wall.
You're framing it all wrong. It's a very Michael Mann-esque.
Yeah.
It's very minimalist.
Let's be European about this, considering our film. Right. I'm going for a Robert Bresson kind of vibe.
There you go.
If I just like reach over, I'm going to grab my journal and drink some Alka-Seltzer and bourbon.
My head is very busy. I like my world to be very calm.
There we go.
Very still. Yeah.
So Liam, we plug off the top. So let's start with Die Hard on a Blank for those poor saps who are not yet listening. What is the premise of your show?
Die Hard on a Blank is a film by film breakdown of every film influenced by Die Hard, starting with the original, right? So starting with Die Hard, we move on to the second episode is about Roadhouse all the way along. So we have films like Executive Decision. It's Die Hard on a Plane again. We just did The Negotiator. It's Die Hard in another skyscraper, this time an Eternal Affairs subdivision. Next week is Snake Eyes, which is Die Hard in a Casino. The week after that is going to be our episode on... Well, you get the idea. So we cover all these movies. There's about 100 of them on our list. And we're about halfway through. We've had great guests coming up. We have Jason Bailey talking about Siege.
Yes,
it's Die Hard under martial law. We've had Sean Fennessy, Paul Scheer, Bilge Ibiri, who's been on your show.
Indeed.
A real mix of dudes, to be totally honest. It's just been a real mix of dudes in their 40s who watched these movies when they were growing up. But it's a lot of fun, and I think we're trying to trace the incredible lineage of the movie and the impact that it's had, because you can trace Die Hard all the way to, like, that movie that came out earlier this year, The Cleaner, with Daisy Ridley, which is also Die Hard in the skyscraper. Mm-hmm. And the big Netflix movie, whose name I've... Carry On. The Colette Sarah movie that I enjoyed. Exactly. So it's like, it's really there. And then we also have a Patreon series, 48 Hours of Buddy Movies, which, you guessed it, traces the influence of 48 Hours on action cinema. We just released an episode on Beverly Hills Cop 2. And actually, right before we were talking, speaking of movie satires, which we're going to discuss today, I was discussing the greatest of all... I was watching, I should say, the greatest of all time, RoboCop, about 40 minutes before this. So to go from RoboCop to The Fireman's Ball is actually not that big of a leap, if you can think about it. But it was kind of cool to watch Fireman's Ball and then be like, now it's time to watch RoboCop.
There you go.
So that's where we are. Yeah.
There's your lineage. All right. Well, we should plug too. 48 Hours of Buddy Movies is only available as a Patreon add-on. www.patreon.com/48hoursofbuddymovies.
That's correct.
And I have to say, as a subscriber myself, well worth the $5 a month.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That's really cool. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's we're kind of just looking at these movies that we grew up with, you know, that kind of like, I saw RoboCop too young. It fucked me up.
Sure.
And so to revisit it now, like, it's kind of cool as an adult. Not that I haven't seen it 45 times since, but we're sort of looking, I think our goal is to be among the first people to really evaluate the artistic and cultural merit of these movies, because as often is the case, when they first come out, we can be very dismissive of them. Con Air, who cares? You rewatch Con Air now and you're like, holy crap.
Right.
There's some things that this movie, that's always the one I point to, or, you know, Tony Scott's Deja Vu, which is coming up later in the series.
Yeah. I think that's really important because, you know, it, I mean, the initial pull for, you know, people of our age who see these titles and want to hear a show about them is that there is, it's a very much a, this, there's a nostalgia connected to all of this. This is, these are sort of cornerstones of 80s mainstream cinema and 90s as you're getting into this period for the Die Hard show. But, you know, it is fascinating to go back and look at these movies through the lens of the commentary that they're making, sometimes subtly, often not so, about the social contract, about race relations, about social issues, about masculinity, big time. Like, all of these movies, whether they were setting out to say something or not, are saying something. And I think that is far and away the most interesting way to approach mainstream cinema, because it is a reflection of what we're thinking and feeling in this particular moment, even if they're not intended as that.
Yeah, 100%. And we've, like, honestly been, and I take it as a compliment. People are like, you're overthinking this, guys. And we're like, well, actually, no, that's not the point. The point is that we, like, I forget what the movie was. Someone's like, Ricochet, that's disposable entertainment. And it's like, there's some things going on in Ricochet that really complicate the idea that this is, you know, entertainment. So, yeah, part of it is going really deep. And that's, you know, it's great to have guests like Scout Tafoya come on and talk about Con Air. You know, guests that really know how to dig in on movies that might not get that kind of love anywhere else.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, they're both terrific shows. Highly recommended. Guide for the Film Fanatic approved. And Liam, what film did you select to discuss with us today?
I chose Milos Forman's The Fireman's Ball from the year 1968, if I remember, or made in 67 and finally really released in 68, which is a interesting backstory to all of that, too.
And normally we would, you know, cut to the original trailer, and due to circumstances that I'm sure have everything to do with the political climate at the time, the original trailer, if there even was one, has not survived. So instead we're going to play a delightful 1 minute long Australian TV spot for the Fireman's Ball.
That's awesome.
Mike, go right ahead.
On Christmas Eve, make sure you get a ticket to the Fireman's Ball. An hilarious black comedy from Czechoslovakia.
From Czechoslovakia. He's so cheerful.
I think Czech is a really beautiful language, but it does not work in a radio ad for, like, a country where they do not speak it, I have to say, pretty candidly.
Yep. But the music is enjoyable.
It is really enjoyable. It's very of the movie itself. It's fun to think about old movie ads and how different they are from now. Like, not like this movie would be made now, but...
Right.
This is great. Have you seen the image? What does this look? What are we seeing? Are we seeing clips from the film?
Yeah, yeah. It's all just little snippets.
Did you guys notice that the band plays a Beatles song in the middle of the big party? Did you notice that?
They sure do.
You know, I gotta say, obviously they didn't, you know, weren't doing sync sound for that stuff, but I was just thinking, like, this movie is wall-to-wall music. Like, it is crazy how much music, and how much those musicians must have been like, okay, I'll pretend to be playing the trumpet for another full day. This is great.
So, yes, our film is The Fireman's Ball, titled Jorge Mapanenko in its native tongue. I'm going to mangle
Jorge Mapanenko. Jorge. So the R with the Hacek overt is a R sound, if I remember correctly.
I'm just going to mangle all of these names.
I feel bad that I gave you a movie with that title as the one you had to say in Czech.
It's fine.
It means fire, my dear, or fire, my lovely, in Czech. More
fire, my lovely.
Are you of a Czech extraction, or is this just a purely intellectual?
This is a big part of the story, is that I lived there.
Oh, shit, I'm interrupting my own show.
No, it's fine, but I'll get into it, but I love that country. I love it. So I'll get into that. And a huge part of why I love that country is this movie. So,
there we have it.
I'm Irish Catholic from Boston.
Different.
Got Liam Billingham. It'd be weird if I were Czech.
I would welcome it. The director is, as we mentioned, Miloš Forman. Miloše Formana in the titles, who co-wrote it with, among others, Ivan Pasur. Now, Pasur, like Forman, would immigrate to America, where his directorial credits would include Cutter's Way and Born to Win, which you can hear Mike and I do an audio commentary for on its Fun City Editions Blu-ray. Plug. Okay.
Wow. I did not know that. That's great.
Yes. Nice connection. So to help us better understand the Czechoslovak New Wave, let's go to Mike with an occasional segment we like to call
Historical Context.
Yes.
Should put like a big, like booming echo on that when you
got it.
When you do it. Okay. No problem. Go ahead, Mike.
I mean, in 1968 is like the year that if anybody knows anything about Czechoslovakian history, what they know about is 1968, right? So like there had been a sort of building freedom movement. I mean, all over the entire Soviet bloc, Czechoslovakia was not being left out of that. And then in January, they had a leader of the Communist Party. I mean, this is a communist country, named Alexander Dubček. I don't never know if I'm saying that
that's
right.
Correct.
But
Dubček.
All right. And
again, I'm not a native speaker, but that's how I've always understood it to be pronounced. Yeah.
That's how I've heard it also. So he tried to basically sort of lighten shit up a little bit, tried to give people a little bit more sort of local control, a little bit more sort of press freedoms. You know, we could talk about the sort of reforms he was proposing, but if you hear about them now, they actually don't sound very impressive at all. But they were enough to really piss off the Reds in the Kremlin. So they basically spent most of a year where there were sort of growing protests in Czechoslovakia. And 1968, you think about it, there's art revolutions happening all over the world. And again,
correct,
Czechoslovakia was not being left out of that. They were, you know, as much of it as they could sort of gather, they were being inspired by it. Artists were trying. And we're going to get into in this movie the way this movie was writing a very, very fine line as far as what you could and could not get away with, right? And so what happened eventually is what was known as the Warsaw Pact invasion, like everything else Warsaw Pact, it was being led by the Soviet, you know, the Russian Soviets. They sent 500,000 troops. They basically occupied Czechoslovakia. They took over the whole country, killed lots of people. And there was 8 months of sort of resistance. But like I said, it was officially a communist country. So there wasn't the sort of military resistance that you're seeing like in Ukraine now. It was civilian resistance. And a lot of it was being done by artists. There was a lot of artistic resistance happening in what was known as the Prague Spring that basically happened all throughout that year. So August, they come in. The movie was an obvious sort of satire, and they knew it. The story is that Miloš Forman was in Paris negotiating his contract to make Taking Off when the censors in Czechoslovakia decided they were through fucking with him. They forced his Czechoslovakian studio to fire him. And then he basically sort of knew that he couldn't go back. And so the story that I've heard is that he went from his negotiations in Paris. He just moved to New York and just fucked off from Czechoslovakia for decades after that. And the movie, as far as I know, was banned there. And it's all sort of, it's very easy to sort of hear that. And it's like, oh, yeah, of course it was banned, whatever. But like it's happening in the context of half a million troops that had just invaded the country, taken over, and were still occupying it when all of this was going on. So it's more of a resistance story than it sort of feels like in our like comfortable little rooms talking on our little microphones right now in a way.
Yeah, 100%. And it's fair to say that like the Prague Spring, those 8 months or whatever it is, are the end of a sort of thawing, you know, that was the Soviets came in and crushed. And part of that is that Prague and the Czech Republic, I would say, was uniquely set up to be a haven for these kinds of artists because they had a national cinema. They had a you know, national funding for cinema. They have a world famous film school that all of these people met at, FAMU. And it was kind of ripe for artists to come in and start making things. And more than that, kind of getting away in realistic, unrealistic, surrealistic ways of criticizing the regime without outright stating those critiques. So it was like really exactly. set up for this kind of movement to occur, I think is an interesting way to put it. And indeed, the crushing of it is partially because of movies like this.
Right, exactly.
And there's a big sort of Five Obstructions vibe in the sense of, like, there was a lot of things they knew they couldn't say, and so the ways they figured out how to say them are all that much more interesting.
Totally.
Right. And the movement that Liam's talking about here was dubbed the Czechoslovak New Wave. You hear it mentioned fairly frequently, mostly in reference to Forman. It was a robust movement of Czechoslovak filmmakers working in the 1960s, kind of up until this point, maybe a few sort of hung around after, but it certainly thinned out. Other key films of the movement included Forman's Black Peter and Loves of a Blonde, Posser's Intimate Lighting, I'm just going to say the titles of the movies so I don't fuck up the beautiful names of the filmmakers who made them. But Closely Watched Trains, Daisies, Valerie and Her Week of Wonders. These are all Czechoslovak New Wave pictures and all well worth seeing. All right, Mike, what does Mr. Danny Perry say about the Fireman's Ball in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Danny says... In the last movie he made in his native Czechoslovakia, Miloš Forman attempted to rip apart the pre-Dubček Czech middle class. That's quite a sentence. That's much easier to read than to say out loud.
Yes.
Miloš Forman attempted to rip apart the pre-Dubček Czech middle class because of its hypocrisy, moral laxity, and propensity for undeserved self-congratulation. This guy can write. That's a lot of like five-syllable words all strung
there
together.
You go.
Firemen decided to throw a ball to honor their retired chief, who's 86 and dying of cancer. It will be good for their own image. Everything goes wrong. The leering, dirty old firemen decide to hold a beauty contest, but only ugly girls enter, and even they are too embarrassed to walk on stage. Firemen are late to a fire that burns down an old man's house. People steal the raffle prizes meant to benefit the old man. A respected fireman is caught red-handed with stolen meat. The ex-chief's gift disappears. Film is somewhat reminiscent of Buñuel's The Exterminating Angel, in which bourgeois party guests can't get home. Here, the party guests stick around to commit mean acts or have them perpetrated on them. Laughter comes from watching self-serving people try to show off their, quote, generosity, benevolence, solidarity, unquote. But cruelty often overwhelms the humor. Also, at times, it seems Forman is attacking people in general. There are no nice people in this film, rather than just bourgeois society. 40,000 Czech firemen quit their jobs to protest this film. They went back to work after Forman insisted that the film wasn't about firemen specifically. But in introducing this film, he states that it is about firemen. I believe he's pointing out the irony of having insensitive, selfish men be the ones Czechs count on to save their family and houses in case of fire. With Joseph Sebank, Joseph Kolb, Vaclav Stockel.
Okay, so Liam,
interesting.
Talk interesting. Us through what's your history with this film in particular, the Czech New Wave in general. How did these movies first make their way to you?
Well, I think like a lot of people, I saw a bunch of Miloš Forman movies in college. You know, Amadeus, you kind of like that high school, college. You kind of get that stuff. But particularly in college, I went to theater school and I had pretty avant-garde minded professors. And so we were reading Václav Havel, the Czech dissident playwright and eventual, you know, president of the country. And so I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then after college, I was having one of those moments where I was like, what am I going to do with my life?
Sure.
And a friend was like, oh, I'm moving to Prague. You want to come? And I was like, why? And he was like, I forget what his reason was. But at that time, it was really easy to live there as an English teacher, or in his case, he was an actor. So like he walks past Daniel Craig in one shot of Casino Royale, that kind of thing.
Right.
Because a lot of movies were shooting there then. A lot. You know, Hellboy had shot there. It was a big time for that country. It was cheap. Everything now shoots in like Bulgaria. But at that time, Prague was where you went. And you could stay without a visa. Nobody cares.
Ah.
So you would just kind of show up, get a tourist visa, I don't think I could be arrested for this now and like work illegally. No one cared. It didn't matter, right? So I moved there in February of 2006. I was 23 years old, and I just was kind of like drinking beer and hanging out, and I didn't know that. I kind of picked it. It was random, right? As one does. And about a few months in, a friend of mine was like, "Oh, they're showing some Czech movies at the Lucerna," which was sort of this palace in the middle of the city that was like a bowling alley and a movie theater. Mm-hmm. It was beautiful. Living there, it's a beautiful place to live. And we went, and the film, they're presenting Czech films with English super subtitles.
Great.
So that was a big thing. Yeah, it was great because they knew there was, at that time, there were 30,000 Americans in the Czech Republic. It's a huge expatriate community. It was massive.
What year range are we talking here?
I was there 06 to 08.
Okay.
But I had a friend who's still there that moved there in 1991.
Holy shit. Okay.
So, like, you know, he was just like, screw it. And he moved back and forth, but has been there now for, you know, yeah, he's the 30-something, 35 years. And I still have friends there. And it was, like, really a fun place to live if you were, like, young and unencumbered. There were a lot of American rock bands there that could play out in, like, real clubs all the time. Mm-hmm. There was big theater festivals as an American. I made theater with a lot of people there. It was just, like, a really great place to live and kind of, like, cheap. You know, you could get by mm-hmm. on $200 a week and live well.
Nice.
Maybe even less. So I was just doing that. Anyway, one evening my friend was like, "Let's go to Lucerna. They're showing Czech films. You should see some of these movies." And the film was The Fireman's Ball. And I was just like, holy shit. Yeah. I'd never seen a movie like this before, you know? And like, because, you know, the foreign films I had been exposed to were like Lars von Trier, you know? Like, it was kind of the more mainstream stuff that was very easy to get in the States in the 90s. This was not an easy movie to find in 2006. You know, it wasn't around.
Sure.
So I saw that. I went back and saw Forman's, his film, Loves of a Blonde, which I think is maybe his Czech masterpiece. And then it just was like, yeah, every couple weeks it was, okay, let's go see this Herzog film. Those films were presented in German with Czech subtitles. So I just kind of sat there and was like, this seems good. And it was just it was kind of an entry point into foreign cinema, right? And not mainstream, not French cinema, not, you know, not what you would expect, not German cinema. I'd seen a lot of German cinema. So it kind of like gave me a new appreciation for it as a country, and it led me down this road. I started to become really interested in other new waves. At that time, the Romanian new wave was going on. So you had films like 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Of course, I can't remember. Lazarescu, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu. All these films were coming out. And Police Adjective, which I think is kind of if you guys haven't seen that film, it's a total masterpiece, one of the best films of the 2010s. And eventually, I can trace going to film school at City College of New York to study with Chantal Ackerman to seeing The Fireman's Ball, because it lit this like spark for me. And and when you sent me the list, I was like, it has to. Or when I looked up the list, I was like, it has to be Fireman's Ball, because it was like the entry drug into this whole world of... I have a friend, you know, it was the entry point into this whole world of movies. And a couple years ago, a friend of mine was like, yeah, you really went off the fucking deep end. Like, we'd be like, what should we watch tonight? Should we watch The Shining? And I'd be like, well, actually, there's this Ukrainian film. Like, whatever it happened to be. They were like, you were no fun. Because, everyone goes through that phase, which is really great to go through from, like, 23 to 30, where you're like, I only watch movies that are subtitled black and white and fucking depressing.
No mainstream trash for me. Yes.
I went through that hard, which is actually a nice bounce back with Die Hard on a Blank, because I'm watching mainstream movies again all the time.
No, I mean, I think that is really, frankly, a key piece to why your shows work, is because you are approaching, you know, very mainstream popcorn movies as someone who has this deep-seated appreciation and understanding of Kurosawa and Romare and all of these sort of big, you know, who in some ways would seem to have nothing in common with the sort of movies you're talking about, and yet they make their way in. What was it that
the Doctor Strange director turns out is a Kurosawa scholar?
Right.
I mean, it's just like,
right.
Yeah.
There's something that's more than the sum of its parts when those things bang their head against each other.
Oh, 100%. And like, you could like that. One of the most exciting things about The Last Jedi, the Rian Johnson Star Wars movie, is that he made a Kurosawa movie and you can see it. Like it's, I sort of think that like a lot of mainstream directors, their like gateway drug is like, I saw Seven Samurai at the age of 16. That's the other gateway drug, is seeing Seven Samurai at like the library when you're 16 and going like, holy shit.
Yeah.
This movie's from 1950. I just saw it again last year on the big screen. I was like, this is the greatest action movie ever made.
Yeah, it really
like,
is.
What do we do, you know? So yeah, I think the part of the appeal of coming back to this movie was its gateway drug quality for me.
What was it that struck you, that sort of knocked you over about it that first time that you saw it? What was so specific and unique and sort of mind-blowing about it as, you know, a young man taking in this scene for the first time?
It's a really good question. I think part of it was just the first thing is that it's the sponge-like nature of your life when you're that age. You know, like I didn't have to wake up and like take care of my kids or go to a regular job. Teaching English then was kind of showing up and being like, so how's your day? And then, you know, it was not a great prep kind of job, at least for me.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it was really easy to kind of like have an existence where you could see 14 things a week and kind of like, so I think my brain was really spongy. I think I viewed time really differently than I do now. Like now, I think you guys know this too. You're like, should I try to start the 2.5 hour movie at 9:15 at night? Like, is that really what I'm going to do right now?
It's probably not going to go well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Within 30 minutes or whatever the case is. So it's like, part of it was the spongy nature of it. I think the other thing that was going on is that at the same moment, I was sort of reading a lot about Czech history, about the history, Mike, that you read when you gave it here, and kind of like thinking about how, you know, in the interview that Forman gives on the Criterion Collection, there's an interview that comes along with the film on the Criterion Channel, and he talks about how like movies... communist films in the 60s were ideological. It was either either are ideological or commercial. So American cinema has commercial pressures. European cinema at this time, Czech cinema, had ideological pressure. And he says that he prefers the commercial pressure of it, right? But I think it was kind of the first time I'd seen a movie that was made in a country where the citizenship may have been at odds with its government in a very, very direct and clear way. And they're trying to communicate something in a deep way. And I think the Czech New Wave, I can't speak to every type of cinema, but I think the Czech New Wave and you know, to get ready for this episode, I rewatched Black Peter, Loves of a Blonde, and Fireman's Ball. Because I was like, well, what is it about Forman in particular?
Yeah.
And I think he found a way. This is the most explicit of the three, but he found a way, I think, to communicate what it means to live politically and also like live a regular life and how, and which feels incredibly timely at this exact moment in this country, but how like, you know, there's a scene in Black Peter early on where Peter gets a job at a grocery store and his job for at least part of the day is essentially to like, make sure that no one is shoplifting. And so he's walking around looking at people and like looking at their bags, and like Forman lets this play for like quite a long time. And so the whole time you're watching it, you're like, why is this playing for so long? And then you realize it's sort of like not a commentary, but kind of like, when you live in a country where, like, you know, this is obviously much more prevalent maybe in East Germany, but it's like he's spying on everyone in that store.
Right.
And the fact that he is spying on them, is that discouraging the theft? Is it, what is it doing, you know, kind of in its way to, which feels to me like a metaphor for living under a totalitarian state, right, at that time. And that's 65, if I remember, or 63, right? So we're sort of beginning in the beginnings of this thawing, this reform period. And then Loves of a Blonde, similarly, has these sequences where, like, the women, there's a scene where one of their teachers in this women's program like tells them all about like living chastely. And he mm-hmm. finds ways to kind of pepper the politics of the time within these like very human stories where the ideology of the country, the communism, whatever the, it's not as important, but it's always there in the exchanges and the interactions and the humanity of the characters mm-hmm. and the tension. And so to me, Fireman's Ball is the most like, frankly, blunt articulation of these ideas. I mean, it's very clearly a metaphor, and he says as much, for mm-hmm. totalitarian leadership and the communist, you know, politibloc under in that period of time. So, yeah, I mean, it, I think it kind of made me reconsider what political cinema can be, because I think when you're 23, you think of political cinema as like, I don't know, Godard to some extent, right. but also like, maybe an American movie that has something that's, I wish I had an easy one that I could kind of reference at this moment, but
well, like,
it was a,
like Nixon would be like a
yes.
political, you know,
or Platoon, yeah. right? Or sure. these movies sure. that kind of like engage directly with politics. I think what mm-hmm. was unique about the Czech New Wave for me at that time was the way it was both emotional, moving, and deeply, deeply political. And I think yeah. the Czechs have a real, especially at this time, had a real ability to do that.
I agree, but I also feel like we should like pause, you know, this notion to make clear that if you're listening or watching and you haven't seen The Fireman's Ball, like to not let all of this conversation about the allegorical mm-hmm. nature and the politics that are going on in the world, and, you know, to feel like this movie is homework in some way.
It's because so goofy, man.
If you understand none of that, if you don't know any of the right. context, it plays as just a really funny farce, like a sort of almost, I would frankly put it closest to like, the early 30s Marx Brothers Paramount movies.
Totally.
This sort of tone of just general irreverence towards authority and organization, but, you know, the specifics of the political commentary you don't have to be familiar with to still enjoy. Like, there's just really good running gags in this thing. There is funny physical comedy. There are comic sequences that build in a really fundamentally traditional comic way. The raffle prize sequence at the Oof. End
yeah.
is, I mean, I was screaming laughing at that. Just and it's because it's playing into how we behave in public, what people will try to get away with, and then also just, you know, the attempts to correct the mistakes that they are making as they go. There seems to be some misunderstanding. We seem to have some jokers here, you know.
Right,
like
right, 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 right.
It's a political
farce
satire,
at times.
But
yeah.
But it is very funny, even if yeah. you're not sort of read in on it.
And it's also kind of great because you're watching these like buffoonish old men not know
yes.
how to, you know, do anything.
Yes.
And a couple of those actors are mainstays of Forman's early Czech films. Mm, you know, okay. The guy whose wife steals the head cheese runs this amazing. There's not a party sequence in Loves of a Blonde. No one comes close to Forman in terms of staging a party. He's incredible at it. Like the awkwardness, the foibles, the kind of things going on behind the scenes, the sure. satire. And there's a similar scene in Loves of a Blonde where these three middle-aged soldiers are trying to pick up these like young girls. It's very similar, actually. These young girls and the kind of like. Guy at the center of it is the guy whose wife steals the head cheese, like one of the main characters. So like you can kind of see this, like there's a mix of actors and non-actors in this movie, right? And he's really goofy. I mean, it's really Czech to me in this movie, right? Which, you know, I think a Czech person could say like, well, it's a stereotype of Czech people, but it is the kind of like silly, buffoonish middle-aged man who thinks he needs to talk in these like very highfalutin ways and have authority when it's like there's a real emperor has no clothes quality to
yes.
how these people behave in this movie.
Yes.
Very quickly, I think it's the Czechs have this figure named Jara Zimmermann, who was like a widely celebrated Czech figure, but he never existed.
Nice.
Okay.
Like, and so like yes. that's when I heard that, I was like, these are a people who know how to take pot shots at themselves.
Right.
Right. Like there's like a kind of like,
yeah,
humor at the core of it, which can be hard to get to. And the other, you know, sort of famous Czech story is the Good Soldier Schweik, which is like about like a well-intentioned soldier from Austro-Hungary, right, who's like gonna do his duty, right? So it's like there's a real tradition of like making fun of themselves and making fun of like the serious traditions of the country, right? And I think you can feel Forman's film feels a little classically Czech in this one in particular to me in that sense, right? While still feeling like the young women are the most sympathetic people in the movie.
Absolutely.
But it's ultimately a very goofy movie. I remember seeing it and feeling very saddened by the end of it, though. The old man who loses his house.
Yes.
I found it kind of...
But that's a funny fucking scene,
it is really
though.
Funny. I mean, like, and he gets in the bed with the other guy. Yeah, it's funny.
Turning him around so he can't see his house burning. They're like, he's still looking.
Right.
And then he's cold, so they move him closer to the fire so he's not so cold. I mean, this is just beautiful, farcical...
That is brutal, though, bro. I mean, the idea that, like, these firemen are not paying attention so this house burns down and that's the joke? Like...
It is!
I mean,
it's really,
no,
really
it is,
bad.
And
yeah.
It's really well done, but just, like, conceptually, that is brutal fucking comedy, dude. To make that work, and it's like... They don't, you know, the fire isn't just sort of something that's happening in the background.
Right.
It's like, you know, we are in the fire. Like, they put the camera as close as they could to the fire without melting the fucking film.
Right.
You know, and we're like, the way that the whole bit is edited, I mean, they really are making a lot of play out of the fire and the danger of the fire.
Yeah.
And
it's so well
still
staged.
The shit is funny.
Yeah.
It's incredibly well staged. It's just like, the whole thing conceptually is so complicated. Very, very well done. That scene especially, that fucked me up out of everything in the movie.
It is kind of disturbing and a hilarious, and like the laugh gets caught in your throat kind
way. And the same thing goes with that long, uncomfortable scene with all the old men and all the contestants in the room behind the bar, which is just like, I mean, first of all, is like uncomfortable. I mean, this is like patriarchy, the movie happening on a very small scale. But also, like, it's hard to stage a scene in one room with that many people and keep it visually dynamic. And that is a thing that I think too often Forman doesn't sort of get credit for, just like the technical, the craft of his stuff.
Yeah.
He's so good at staging, at blocking for camera, at moving things within the frame, at keeping it dynamic without having to be like cut, 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 cut.
Yeah. I Forman is like one of the goats.
He
and
is.
I weirdly feel like in this age of like everything getting reclaimed, actually this is good, right? Like, I'm a little shocked that Forman doesn't have a bigger like online reputation.
I mean,
maybe
I think
that's
a
coming
lot
with
of it...
Amadeus and the 4K re-release,
maybe.
But like,
I
don't
I
know,
feel
man.
Like he a lot of us who are involved in those conversations, we sort of came up. I think the thing that needs to be reclaimed is his sense of playfulness. Is his is you know, and this film is a good example of him as kind of a prankster, because
totally.
I think the thing is, when you grow up in the 80s, if you were a kid and Amadeus came out and you didn't maybe even see it when it came out, it looks like, we talked about this when we covered it in our 1984 show, it looks like this very sort of stuffy costume drama
masterpiece
thing.
Theater
looks very masterpiece
yeah, totally.
Theater. Absolutely.
That's a good point. Absolutely.
And so, and then the other thing that everyone knows him from is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which whatever the sort of, you know, and it is a transgressive movie. It has all of these themes. It's a movie that won the big five Academy Awards. So it also sort of smacks of this respectability. And I think maybe that's the thing that Forman,
that's a good point,
that should be reclaimed for Forman, is not, you know, whether he was great, because that's sort of assumed. It's the idea that he was a much more pranky, transgressive, eye-poking filmmaker than you might think.
Who's the filmmaker that made Lassie Hallström, right? I wonder if like maybe they get incorrectly, with no disrespect to Lassie Hallström, but like they maybe get grouped incorrectly together because it's like Forman sort of, I don't think Forman was ever like, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna make Move to America and make one of the most celebrated movies of the 70s And one of one of the most celebrated movies of the 80s. I think it's a byproduct, right? Of course, mm-hmm. Naturally it is. But I think that the sort of Academy respect that he would get changed the way he was perceived as an artist. And like, I would actually say to his credit, he constantly tried to bring that playfulness back. People versus Larry Flint, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, any of these kinds of movies that he would make, he made Man on the Moon.
He did.
And so it's like he's clearly aware of identity and perception. Like that scene in Man on the Moon, I haven't seen it maybe since it came out, where Andy goes to get healed and it's really like a fake. That's like they put the sponge on his body and make it look like they've removed an organ. Is like forming to a T.
Very much so.
To me, right? Like this kind of like the seriousness of something, but like it's all a fake. Or I would say he has a pretty dim view of humanity a little bit. But I think you're right. I think like respectability politics kind of like grasped onto Milos Forman, as opposed to him being allowed to be like a prankster and a goofball with a real heart, with like a real human heart.
Yes. Well said. Okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll talk about the movie's release and reception. Friends, let's talk about the release and reception of The Fireman's Ball. See, I hoped that you were going to introduce me and ask how my, or you were going to interrupt me.
Oh, goddamn, let's do it again. Let's do it again. Let's do it again. I don't want to presume because it's your show, but all right, let's do it.
Friends, let's talk about the release and reception.
How was your break, Jason? How was your break?
There you go. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good Lord.
Let's talk about the release.
I'm exporting the stupid jokes from my own show to your show.
You may as well. You may as well.
What is a crossover episode without some crossover jokes? Come on.
There we go.
We need
it. It's Die Hard at a fireman's ball.
Oh, God.
One
All right.
Location.
Fireman's ball.
Just saying.
It's true. It's true. Opened in New York on October 1st, 1968, after closing the 68 edition of the New York Film Festival a few days before. Yep. Also playing in New York on that day, this buckle in, Godard's Weekend, Truffaut's The Bride Wore Black, Polanski's Repulsion, Bunuel's Belle de Jour.
Oh my God.
It's a good weekend to go to the movies.
Oh my God.
The Producers, The Odd Couple, Wild in the Streets, Charlie, Petulia, Hang 'em High, Funny Girl. Oh, and a little picture called 2001 A Space Odyssey.
I was born like 20 years too late, is my theory.
God. Yeah. Mike, what were the news headlines on that?
Wednesday, October 2nd, 1968, they were arguing in the Senate about cutting off a filibuster of proposed Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas. It was very high stakes.
Hmm.
I feel like we hear about this, like, cutting off a filibuster in the Senate tactic as, like, basically something Mitch McConnell invented, but basically not.
No, they've been shitheads a lot longer than that, let me tell you.
I mean, has anybody ever heard of Chief Justice Abe Fortas? Me fucking either. So, right?
Yep.
Her Majesty QE2 was big mad at a French magazine called Paris Match for publishing photos from her family album that she considered too personal.
Oh.
Any idea what she was doing in these private pics?
Oh, no.
Nudes, perhaps?
Ooh.
No, she was holding her kids. Look, these people might not be fucking lizards, but they're not humans. I don't know what they are, but they don't. Their blood is cold.
All right.
And finally,
hold on. Shout out to your co-host. Can you do the Britannica? There you go. There you go. We love you, Mr. Gawthorne.
We love you, Phil. I don't mind that you're British. I hope he doesn't listen to this.
And finally, the Vatican published a 5,700-word document explaining to Catholics and other Christians how to talk to Marxists and other atheists to create a prudent dialogue.
Oh.
I realize there has been a lot of news about the Catholic Church in these segments, but in my defense, there was a lot of news about Catholics in the paper then. I don't know why. Anyway, from what I can tell, the whole thing was dedicated to giving their flock tools to combat the whole, you know, Jesus was a radical leftist defender of marginalized communities thing that people get when they actually read the book they supposedly worship. So the Catholic Church needed to get it out in front of combating
there
that idea. that.
You know, speaking of RoboCop, you know who's a Jesus scholar?
Huh? Is Paul Verhoeven?
Paul Verhoeven, yes. All right. I have his Jesus of Nazareth book,
Liam,
which he signed at the IFC Center at the Life of Brian screening. Like 10, 15 years ago.
So not only do you have to mention Verhoeven on every episode of your own podcast, but you have to make sure to mention him when you guest on anyone else's as well.
He's the greatest to ever do it.
There you go.
I don't know
there
what else to say. I don't know what
What's
else to say.
What's a crossover episode without
there
crossovers?
It's, yeah, exactly.
There we go, right?
Exactly.
There
that,
we go.
Perfect. Wrap up for headlines. Jason, what did the critics have to say about Fireman's Ball?
Well, it originally played in New York theaters and at the New York Film Festival alongside a Czech New Wave short documentary called Oratorio for Prague.
Mm-hmm.
When they screened it, because it's a very short movie. We didn't mention that. It's like 73 minutes. When they screened at the fest, the New York Times' Renata Adler dubbed it, quote, by far the finest movie program showing at that moment anywhere in New York, end quote.
And we just heard what was playing in New York.
Well, and Forman gives her a lot of credit because, mm-hmm. you know, the story is that he made this movie and Carlo Ponte was a producer.
Yep.
And when Carlo saw a cut of the movie, he wanted his money back.
Yeah.
And so Francois Truffaut
what a piece of shit,
paid him
Carlo
back
Ponte.
For it. Yeah, I mean, he made some great movies, but not ideal. And I mean, this movie is a victim of good timing in that I think, mm-hmm. like, New York, if the New York Film Festival is what it is, well, can be like, you know, it's going to shine mm-hmm. a light on these kinds of
Absolutely.
Films in a given year, right? And I think that the positive review combined with the showing at the New York Film Festival, still my favorite film festival in the world, mm-hmm. is like, it's a really, it really probably helped the film get legs, right? Like, and I the Czech films were being celebrated abroad, but like, again, it's like, it's not like it is now. Like, it's crazy to me. Old man speech that like on the Criterion Channel, I can just be like, holy shit, like 40 of these movies are just available now. You know, it's crazy that they're all there under, you know, a catalog together.
Right.
And you can just watch these movies that were so hard to find 15 years ago.
Yep. Adler also called Fireman's Ball, quote, a hilarious Shaggy Dog story with the pessimism of the exquisite logic that leads nowhere. It's true. The timing and involutions of the humor are such that there is escalating laughter while an awareness of the sadness of things, real fire, monumental pettiness deepens as well. That a director who sees things so bitterly and clearly can be this funny now may mean that we are in for a comic renaissance after all. At the Village Voice, Andrew Saris called it, quote, the best thing he has ever done and by far the funniest film around. That he works on a small canvas misleads some critics into treating his art as minor, but the reverberations of the Fireman's Ball mark him instead as a major miniaturist, a master of the incisive indiscretion. Archer Winston of the New York Post praised the core of the Forman comedy in truth, people of good intentions but limited understanding and sympathy, as so many of us are, bumble through life making horrible messes of things. People aren't bad, they're human. They do their best, but things have a way of going wrong. It's funny, it's sad, but above all, it's deeply true and universally human that we can only look, recognize our distant brothers and sisters, feel with them. I only found one minor complaint. Wanda Hale from the New York Daily News wrote that it is, quote, bright, clever, reveals the Czech sense of humor, but lacks the charm that we have come to expect from that country. She continued, the disasters, the lack of human obligations or warmth come from an embittered perception of human nature, end quote. So it sounds like she has
you got a problem with that, Wanda?
Minor
you got
complaint.
Got a problem? The fuck out of here, Wanda. Are you paying attention or not?
Minor complaint that Mr.
Perry
had.
Shit gives you a lot of reasons to be pessimistic, Wanda.
Some dislike when there's literally no one to like in a movie. And
I mean, it's a mean-edged movie. The movie's mean.
It is.
It's mean, you know? And it was accused of being mean. But, you know, I want to go back to that Saris review where he is like, it's a minor, major work. That feels like a really good encapsulation of the Czech New Wave. Because it doesn't have this reputation that the French New Wave has, right? It doesn't have the, you know, when you go to film school, it's like French New Wave, French New Wave, French New Wave, right? Czech New Wave, at least back, you know, you had to look a little deeper. You had to like kind of find that one on your own, right? And that's because there's like a minor major. These are all like movies about, that are big in idea and often smaller in execution. There are exceptions to that. The film Marchetta Lazarova, which is like a medieval epic, which is unbelievable and worth seeing. But like a lot of these movies are, yeah, people in like bohemian dance and that bohemian halls, right, fucking up and making out under tables and like being allegorically about,
yeah,
totalitarianism, right? Like,
but that's part of, I think that's part of like what they had to do to get away with it is totally this idea that, you know, you're seeing this committee of guys who are running this fireman's ball that's supposed to be, you know, just sort of a shout out to one of their friends, but it's very easy to read the Comintern in that little group. And I think that's one of the things that, like, no, I'm not making fun of the Comintern. It's just these guys and this little thing.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but it's the ways, the failures are so sort of particular to that type of organization that it reads even if, you know, hey, come on. I'm just saying. I'm just saying.
Well, totally. And it's like, we were talking about earlier about like Foreman's prankish, mischievous quality. Like, and one of the things I love about his movies is they have that quality of like, this could be a documentary, maybe less this one than the other ones.
Sure,
right.
Sure.
But like, I mean, the story is that they went to a little town in Bohemia to write another movie and they went to a fireman's ball and they were like, this is the movie.
Right.
But he especially loves Of a Blonde, which I really think is a masterpiece. But like that film feels at times, especially in its similar dance hall or sequence, that like he's just kind of capturing as the world as it is. And yet because he has to smuggle these ideas into his movies, he has this like remove. He steps back a little bit and it makes its point, but like you're laughing at it as opposed to being like, oh yes, totalitarianism is terrible. Like it's built into it without it feeling like he's in the way that, you know, Weekend has direct address to the camera talking about capitalism.
Sure.
Like this is the opposite of that. It's like,
correct,
it's like Brecht light. If Weekend is like Brecht heavy,
yeah,
Foreman, the Czech New Wave is Brecht light a little bit.
That totally makes sense. How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
Saris led off his review by noting that the film was reportedly doing disappointing business. But it did well in its homeland, at least until it was banned forever after the Russian takeover, and it played around the world with some success. As Jason mentioned, it played at the 1968 New York Film Festival. It was also selected to play at Cannes that year, but that was the year when there was no Cannes Film Festival on account of the civil unrest in France that spring. 1968 was jumping the fuck off. Something to be said for the power of a general strike and some civil disobedience, baby.
Amen.
It's like maybe the most crucial year of the 20th century.
I mean,
it's up
arguably
there. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of forgot that France had its most significant strikes
did.
In the same year. Like until I was
did.
Like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did not play a can because there was no can.
I also think what's interesting about the politics of this is that when Carlo Ponti asked for his money back, Foreman could have gone to jail. Because the establishment had this law that essentially said that, like, you're stealing from the people's fund. It was kind of like he owed the state money, and if he couldn't pay it back, you know, so Truffaut coming in and being like, here's the money for your paying Ponti back, like, is probably why Foreman was able to get to France, negotiate taking off, and then be like, I'm not fucking going back. And I think he goes back in 84 to shoot Amadeus, because that was shot both in Prague and... Hungary, if I remember correctly.
That sounds right.
Yeah. It's sometimes I think we think like, art, how much impact can it have on politics? And it's like, in the case of this, it's like the arts and politics are so interwoven.
Yeah. And I gotta say too, I hadn't heard that Truffaut story until I was researching for this episode.
Yeah.
And that's a baller move. Truffaut so often in the sort of like, in the French New Wave histories, in the Truffaut-Godard, like, is seen as sort of like the, you know, the sort of milquetoast mainstream counterpart to, you know, the radicalism of Godard, etc.
Right.
But like, that's a pretty, like, to put your money where your mouth is in terms of subversive art at that moment, I think speaks quite highly of Mr. Truffaut.
No, totally. It's like, because a lot of the stories you hear about him, like, you know, shitting on the Apu trilogy when it premieres at Cannes and like these kind of icky stories. But no, this, like, I had forgotten this until I watched the interview today. And I was like, oh, yeah, like we owe We probably owe the fact that these films are so well known internationally, at least partially, to Truffaut.
Yeah.
Getting that money to them and then the film playing it. Because it would have probably been destroyed.
Yep. Yep.
So, it's not getting out of Czechoslovakia. Yeah. No fucking way. Are they going to be like, yeah, cool. Yeah, you can export it. No problem. There's so many instances of that in film history.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not just, it's not just Czech films. There's so many films that it's shocking that we've been able to see.
Yeah. So shout out to Truffaut. Mike, how did it do on awards?
Fireman's Ball was also nominated for Best Foreign Film at the 41st Academy Awards, presented in April of 69. Believe it or not, the Oscars used to come even later in the following year, God help us. But it lost to the epic four-part Soviet film adaptation of War and Peace. I'm sure they were very happy about that at the Kremlin.
Good point.
That War and Peace is good. It must be said. It's pretty
incredible. I gotta say, I haven't seen it because the Fireman's Ball is 73 minutes and that one combined is like 1,000 minutes.
God, if that was up now, there'd be like think pieces for months about whether or not it's a movie, right? It's incredible. But for sure.
Russians now, can make a movie. I don't think anybody's ever disputing that. They're just shit at government.
There we go. Now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Liam, you are our guest, which means you go first.
So my double is let me check the date on this because I want to get it right. I'm programming for you guys a Band in Czechoslovakia double feature.
Awesome.
And this film is also available on the Criterion Channel. When I saw it, it was really, really, really hard to track down. It's called Ucho, which translates as the ear, and it is a Czech film by Karel Kačina. It was made in 1970, and it was not released until 1989. Now, the reason this movie is significant is that it begins with a drunk couple arriving at home from a regime party. If I remember correctly, it's set in the 50s, so Stalin is front and center. And they arrive back at home, and they're drunk, and they find that their phone isn't working, and their spare house keys are gone, and they realize that they're under surveillance by the state for reasons that are unclear to them in the moment. And yet the movie flashes back to the party throughout, but does it from the POV of the husband.
Okay.
So there are these long Nickel Boy-esque sequences, first-person flashbacks. So I kind of describe the movie as like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf meets like a Harold Pinter play. It has this like really paranoid vibe. It's absolutely incredible. And when it first became available here, I was like, I can't believe that this movie is. And now people are seeing it. So The Ear, or Ucho, which is the Czech title, directed by Karel Kačina. Very different tone, much darker. This is a dark fucking movie, but it's absolutely incredible. And then I think you should watch Ucho first, then watch The Fireman's Ball, and then finish your night with like a Christopher Guest movie. Because I feel like if you want something that's in the vein of like satire, like The Fireman's Ball, Christopher Guest's, there's a little bit of like Foreman's documentary DNA, I think, in a Christopher Guest film, like The Best in Show or one of those films.
There we go. All right. My pick is wildly predictable. We've even mentioned it earlier in the show, but I do think I recommend programming a Foreman double bill of The Fireman's Ball and Taking Off, which is one of my favorite early 70s movies. There's like an entire episode about Taking Off on our Fun City Cinema podcast. So I'll link that here and not dribble on about it too long, but it's a very charming movie about the generation gap, about, suburban parents and New York hippie youth. It has an incredible Buck Henry performance, some beautiful, early 70s New York City photography. You really get the sense in that movie that Foreman has been living in the city and like falling in love with it for those 2 years.
Totally. Yeah, he gets it.
He totally gets it. And it has, though, you can definitely see the same filmmaker at work. It has the same, that sense of mischief and playfulness that we talked about is very much present in this. It is, frankly, a little gentler towards figures of authority than this one is. I think he's more sympathetic to, say, the parents in this movie. And just, if you haven't, if you need to be convinced, go on YouTube and find the scene in Taking Off where Vincent Schiavelli is teaching a bunch of parents how to smoke pot. And if you can watch that scene and not want to see the entire movie, then you are made of stone. Mike, what is your pick?
So, like, the end of this movie, you know, opens up a little bit. We get outside, we start dealing with some of the wives, you know, even like once they get into the room for the beauty contest. But, like, the first half of this movie is just like three or four dudes just sort of whispering to each other and you know, wearing their goofy uniforms and trying to make decisions. And all I could think about was Death of Stalin, dude.
Which,
sure.
I mean, obviously 100%. It's even sort of the same era. You know, obviously it's sort of depicting Russians instead of Czechs, but all of that sort of nobody really like knows what to say.
There's all sort
of ridiculous fucking negotiations going on. It's a comedy about something that is not obviously funny.
That's a really good pick.
I mean, that's one of those things where, like, when I heard there's Death of Stalin, I was like, oh, wild. That's going to be weird. And then I heard the cast list, and I was like, no fucking way. They're making a joke out of this thing. It's great. It's hilarious. Yeah. It's just one of those things where, like, there's not a lot of movies that can take something so dark and so, you know, sort of the big brother, you know, sort of overseer thing and make laughs out of it. This is the only one I've seen other than Death of Stalin, I think, sort of like lives in that specific world. So, yeah, if you haven't seen Death of Stalin, can't recommend it highly enough.
Good pick. All right, Liam, the shows are Die Hard on a Blank and www.patreon.com/48hoursofbuddymovies. Where can people follow you on social media?
Well, I'm on Blue Sky. So if you follow Jason, you can find me. I'm a little off the social media lately for reasons. I still have an X account. I'm not really on it that much, but yeah, you can find me on Blue Sky. You can find me on X, Liam Billingham, the Instagram. But you know, you can also just, those are the best places. I'm like trying not to talk to people on the internet anymore because of where we are, but I'm there and my website is liambillingham.com.
I am Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I am Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And you know the drill, folks. If you like the show, you think other people might like it too, please leave us a rating and or review on your podcatcher of choice. And as Liam likes to say, tell your movie podcast-loving friends. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get weekly show notes and such, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. And if you'd like to make a donation to support us and the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And finally, if you're one of those freaks who likes
very
to watch
fine
videos
people.
Of people recording a podcast, hello, find us on YouTube on our
I'm
channel.
I'm not a serial killer, I promise.
Guide for the film fanatic.
Oh, God,
fanatic.
You can see the babies die. Oh, my God, it's a crib over here? Like, it's terrifying.
It's not weird at all.
I'm like the Buffalo Bill or something. I don't know what's going on here. It's terrifying. Thanks, guys, for having me on. This was really fun. Anytime I can talk about Czech cinema, I'm a happy guy.
Awesome. Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic, and shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, who will always be our winner of the Miss Fireman Beauty Contest.
He
is a handsome man. Thank you again, Liam.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. Join us next time as our guest, New York Times bestselling author Megan Abbott, discusses her new novel El Dorado Drive and Brian De Palma's 1984 sleazecore classic Body Double. See you then.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.